This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine, your host for Trumpet Hour. This is our week in review program. We're going to survey the important news from all over the world. And to talk about this, I have with me here in the studio some of our writing staff, Robert Morley.
Good to be here.
Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
Anthony Chibadirwe.
Hello.
And via Skype from our office in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
We've been talking a lot lately about events in Europe with the immigration crisis, with terrorist attacks, Europe's shifting political landscape. And there is more to report on those stories today, but we're going to start in a different part of the world today, Australia. The cover story for this week's Trumpet Weekly describes how, for the next century, Australia's northernmost port, Darwin Port, is going to be controlled exclusively by the Chinese. It's been announced that a Chinese-owned corporation named Landbridge Group will now have day-to-day operation and control of this port for the next 99 years. They paid 506 million Australian dollars for this privilege. Now, there are a lot of very concerning details about this deal, and to get into some of these, we're going to turn it over to Robert.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of disturbing details about this. One of the things that caught my attention was just how downplayed this deal was in the media. It didn't get a lot of attention at all. Politicians, when they did talk about it, it was to really downplay any potential significance to this deal.
It was actually released in October, middle of October. So here we are 2 months later catching up with this.
Right, absolutely. This Landbridge Group. And when you look into it, you'll see why politicians in Australia probably wanted to keep things on a down low, didn't want a lot of media attention. When they talked about this company, they talked about it as a private enterprise corporation. It even has an anglicized name to it, Landbridge Group. But when you start digging into it, you quickly find out that they aren't really private at all, at least not in the way that we would think of a private corporation. The Landbridge Group chairman is a man named Ye Cheng. And he's tied very, very closely to the government of the People's Republic of China. He's a senior member of the 12th National Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference Committee. Big title. But basically, these guys, this guy takes direct orders from the Communist Party of China. He's a very high-ranking member. And the fact that he is the CEO or a senior member of this corporation determines that the Chinese government does have a direct pathway into this corporation that will be controlling the port of Darwin, which, as you mentioned, is the most important port on Australia's northern coast. This company is an arm of the Chinese government, as so many important companies in China are. Now, as people have been digging into this company, they're finding out it's actually a front for the Chinese military. Even the company's website, this shows you how little due diligence was done on this. The company's website even talks about how it was instrumental in creating, quote unquote, the People's Armed Militia of China. So an armed militia group in China. It talks about how it assists the Chinese military in problem solving, in logistics, in maritime training. It talks about how it provides scientific and technological support for the Chinese military. This is the company that the Australian government has turned over to the Chinese. And when they did this, they made a big show about how, you know, the Defense Department wasn't worried about this, et cetera. And what has come out since then is just how hastily this deal was pushed through. The Australian Defense Minister, Marie Payne, she was interviewed following this deal, and she came out and actually said that she only knew about this deal a few hours before the contract was announced. So this is the defense minister in Australia, was not consulted before this deal took place. And this is the port that Australia uses for all of it, for the majority of its northern operations, for its naval operations. And not just that, it is the port that's used by the United States military. So this actually has a direct impact on America. As if you know, we station 2,500 Marines in Australia. And that is the port that supplies come into and out of. That's the port that U.S. military vessels come into and out of. In Australia, United States base is located adjacent to that port. So a lot of military analysts are looking at this and saying, what a wonderful opportunity China has just picked up here to eavesdrop on American operations, see what is going on. Not only American operations, Australian. They use that port as well. And even though some politicians have said this isn't going to impact the military, they'll still be able to use this port. Well, a report has come out that actually this Chinese company is already making changes. There was an amphibious a vehicle ramp that the Australian government installed in that port at a cost of $18 million. Well, this company now has come out and said that Australian military vehicles actually only be able to use this ramp at certain times of the year, 60 days out of the year. The rest of the time, they're going to devote it to economic civilian traffic. And they said, we're only going to guarantee we'll let you use it for the next 20 years. After that, we're not even guaranteeing you can use this ramp at all that you built, that taxpayers spent money building. So there's a lot of just disturbing details that are coming out from this deal. President Obama has since come out and said, hey, why didn't you consult me on this? I just worked with you to send additional troops to Australia, and you didn't even give me a call that you were doing this. So even President Obama is quite upset about this.
I think Americans have to have a certain amount of deja vu with this story because of what happened in the Panama Canal and the Communist Party links that the organization that took over, apparently, again, another quote-unquote private corporation that took over control of the Panama Canal and yet very close ties with the communist government in China. Same story here.
Same story, and it's really just part of a trend that we're seeing across Southeast Asia and even around the world. I mean, China is the biggest economic trading power in the world. It has surpassed the United States. And because of that, its tentacles in terms of ports and trade and logistics are expanding in a way that we haven't seen since the British Empire expanded around the globe, really. And this acquisition of this port in Darwin, which is so strategic for Australia. In World War II, that was where Australia's base was. That was the defense of Australia was based out of Darwin for a huge portion of that war. It got bombed by the Japanese. But if you look at that part in Southeast Asia, and I know, Jeremiah, you watch these areas as you keep track of what's going on in Southeast Asia, but China has been acquiring ports and infrastructure all through that area as it's moving, making sure it can secure trade and the flow of goods and resources in and out of China.
Before we get to that, just one quick question. What's in this for Australia? Was it just a money grab?
Well, China is a very, very powerful nation. It's not a nation that can be ignored anymore. And I think politicians in Australia didn't want to upset the Chinese. They didn't think it was worth creating a diplomatic issue over this port. And I think that they just figured, you know, we're going to get some money out of this. And we don't think this is worth upsetting and offending the Chinese.
So there's just a certain amount of trust in China. There has been this relationship developing between Australia and China.
Well, they are, absolutely. China is Australia's most important trade partner now. It's not the United States. It's China. Australia's resources all go north to China.
And here's an instance where they were actually willing to upset the Americans for the sake of making this deal with the Chinese. So looking at the bigger picture, Jeremiah, and China's establishment of really a strong presence in ports all over the world. This fits in with the pattern that we've been following for some time now.
Yeah, that's right. This is a really stark indication of just the rise of the power of China. It's coming to control more and more ports around the world, and that means more strategic control over some of these ocean lanes that are just crucial for global trade. And I think one really significant aspect of this is something that we've written about on The Trumpet for quite a while. We have a chapter in our booklet, He Was Right, that just talks about everything that Mr. Armstrong said about
Herbert W. Armstrong, yeah, major prophecy that he talked about in the United States and Britain in prophecy.
Yes. Yeah, it was really one of his linchpin prophecies, just talking about that the U.S. and Britain would come to control lots and lots of vital sea gates, lots of ports all around the world, but then that they would lose them. And there are specific passages in the Bible that say, yes, America and Britain will come to control these, but then they will also lose them. And of course, Australia is a part of that Commonwealth of Great Britain. And so I think that our article, our chapter in the He Was Right booklet might need to be updated now that Darwin is going the same way as Suez, as Panama.
Well, you know, it's interesting because the other ports that we talk about so much, it says the gates of his enemies. Now here they're actually giving over the gate on their own soil.
Yeah, in some ways it seems even more significant. Why don't you move right into our backyard here, and here are the keys to one of our most strategic hubs. Hope it goes well for you.
It really is remarkable. The story in this week's Trumpet Weekly, written by our Callum Wood, who lives down in that part of the world, and definitely worth checking out. It's the cover story for the Trumpet Weekly this week. This is our high-quality report that we produce each week with significant stories from around the world to really give you an overview of what's going on. You can join over 32,000 other subscribers who receive this in their email inbox every week. We're going to move now to the Middle East and to Anthony. And if we could start with the overview of headlines from the Middle East, Anthony.
Okay, there were reports this week that Iran's General Qasem Soleimani was back in Moscow last week. You might remember that he visited Moscow in July in violation of travel sanctions, UN travel sanctions against him, but the Russians welcomed him. And an Iranian news agency this Wednesday reported that he was back in Russia last week. But then it turned, the Iranians later on denied the report. They denied that he had visited Russia, and the Russians also denied that visit. But an Iranian news agency, which is associated with the Iranian government, broke this news about this visit. So we are not sure exactly who's telling the truth. Truth is a very scarce commodity in the Middle East, but there's a lot going on in there. And Turkey's ambassador to Qatar said on Wednesday that Turkey will establish a military base in Qatar as part of a defense agreement aimed at helping to confront common enemies. Now, both of these countries, they are working hard to fight against Assad's regime in Syria. And another story that we have in the Trumpet Weekly concerns that group that you might remember as being referred to as a JV team, the terrorist group that was reportedly contained. That's what our politicians told us. But the FBI director came on Wednesday and said that this terrorist group has revolutionized terrorism around the world. They talked about how it's inspiring small groups across the world to conduct lone wolf attacks, how it's manipulating social media with encrypted communications to send out this message. And there's also another report, and this was a warning from the Pentagon, that the Islamic State is now more operationally active in Afghanistan. And they've already started fighting against the Taliban, and some groups that have splintered from the Taliban have joined up with the Islamic State. Again, a group that politicians were telling us has been contained, but it's just expanding.
All right, and your top story of this week?
Now, the top story this week is about a development in Egypt that I think is the most prophetically significant in the Middle East this week, is something we've been talking about for over 20 years. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has talked consistently about the Bible prophecies indicating that radical Islam in Egypt will certainly take on greater influence in Egyptian politics. The Jerusalem Post has had an article about that development and is saying that the Islamic State is actually cooperating with Hamas in Egypt to fight one common enemy, and that common enemy is the Egyptian government. It talks about how both groups, Hamas and Islamic State, they both have their origin with the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. So both have some common roots, and now they are working together and cooperating in smuggling weapons. One thing that I think is important to bring up at the beginning is that oftentimes you have all these different terrorist groups around the world in the Middle East. They all have different ideologies, And oftentimes we just look at them and think of them as just constantly fighting against each other. However, what's important to realize is that there are times, there have been times in the past when these groups have worked together in spite of their ideological differences. They've worked together for a common cause, and that is exactly what's happening in Egypt. This article in the Jerusalem Post, it talked about how both groups have different purposes and intentions. It says, Hamas needs the Islamic State to break the Egyptian siege on Gaza. So that is Hamas, that's what Hamas expects. Whereas the Islamic State needs Hamas to give it more of its, to share more of its technological know-how in building bombs and that type of thing, rockets and other weapons. So you have these two terrorist groups that normally would be fighting against each other probably, but now that they have a common cause, it's about Egypt, and they are mutually dependent on each other. They're actually working together to bring down the Egyptian government. You know, the Egyptian government is putting a lot of pressure on Hamas, on Gaza. They have this siege on Gaza. So Hamas is now asking the Islamic State to help up with that. So it's a pretty significant, especially when we look at Egypt right now. Right now we have President al-Sisi in power, and he has been working hard to remove all traces of radical Islam in the country, and he has done a lot of progress in that regard.
But there's a lot of pressure against him, and you know, we've been following that story, just how much we expect, because of biblical prophecy, we expect Egypt to change, to turn back to a more Iranian aligned orientation, and this could very well help that along.
It could, and like we said, we've been talking about this for over 20 years, and there have been times when there was absolutely no sign that radical Islam would be that dominant in Egypt. But over the years, we've been seeing a lot of developments pointing toward the fulfillment of those prophecies. So it is important to just keep watching how these small groups, as insignificant as they might seem on the world stage, it's important to just look at them, what they are doing, how they're combining their strengths to try to bring about this this radical Islamic movement in Egypt. And we know that the Bible indicates that radical Islamic movement in Egypt will be aligned with Iran.
Thank you very much, Anthony. We're going to turn now to Europe. Richard, you've been a busy man today with the Trumpet Daily this morning. I wanted to start by just giving you the opportunity to give us a rundown of what you covered in the Trumpet Daily this morning.
Sure. Well, the main thing we talked about is a very important speech Angela Merkel gave on Monday. There was a lot of pressure on her speech, because she has been fighting off a lot of criticism from within her party. And the general consensus is that she gave one of the best speeches of her career, which is noticeable. She's not really noted for being a great speaker. So it's a very interesting speech. But one of the most interesting things she said in there was an attack on multiculturalism. She said that multiculturalism leads to parallel societies, and multiculturalism therefore remains a lie. And she talked about how multiculturalism is the opposite of immigration. Now, this isn't necessarily new for Ms. Merkel. She condemned multiculturalism and talked about how it had failed in December 2004. She brought up the subject again in 2010. But there is something different and something much more significant about saying multiculturalism has failed when you're in the middle of an immigration crisis, when you're just coming in the weeks after a major terrorist attack. Just the environment now in which she's saying it makes those statements much more significant. And that's very significant that she'd come out and repeat them. So in today's program, we talked about the failings of multiculturalism and how it inevitably leads to this kind of ghettoization, alienation, a buildup of resentment on both sides, both for the migrants who end up kind of living in these deprived enclaves and within the local population. And then we talked about, once again, about how this is building to a crisis in Germany. And really, we talked about a couple of articles, both of which are in today's Trumpet Weekly. One of them is called Merkel, Muslims and the Problems of Multiculturalism by George Friedman from his website, Geopolitical Futures. And Fear, Anger and Hatred, The Rise of Germany's New Right from Spiegel Online. So we went into some of the material from both of those about how this is building to a real crisis and transformation within Germany.
All right. Very interesting. And before we move to your top story, the overview of any other European headlines that you wanted to cover.
Well, as has been very common in recent weeks, so much of the news in Europe revolved around the immigration crisis and around the aftermath of the Paris attacks. And so Europe was trying to throw around some ideas now to solve the problem. How do we control our borders? How do we stop terrorists from crossing our borders? And one of the big ones that was initially unveiled on Monday was for Europe to put together what's essentially a European army, a mini European army. And we talked about this on the program on Wednesday. This army would be deployable to any nation within Europe's open border area, even without the permission of that nation. And then just last night, Europe moved forward with this plan. They decide they're going to negotiate this now, and they want to get all the details hammered out within the next 6 months. And if this goes ahead, that is going to be, and as it looks like it will, that's a huge development for Europe. That's one of the biggest handovers of sovereignty that we've ever seen. We talked about this a bit on the program as well, that fundamentally a nation state has a monopoly of force within its own borders, and Europe now looks like it's getting ready to surrender that.
That's pretty amazing. We've been talking about this kind of development for a long time. So your top story for this week from Europe?
My top story is we have an article in this week's Trumpet Weekly called Shattered Hopes, A Farewell to European Arms Control. And this article goes through how there's a whole number of arms control agreements between Europe and Russia that are now coming absolutely unraveling. And so just to give some of the background, you had during the Cold War this big buildup of forces on both sides within Europe, within the USSR, and both nations were kind of piling on the tanks and the nuclear weapons, and all these arsenals were going up and up and up. And then at the end of the Cold War, both sides decided they wanted to dial down the tensions, they wanted to save money on their military, and so they start signing these treaties that limit the arms buildup and that calm everything down. And this article goes through about how just about all of those treaties are now becoming unstuck. They're now unraveling. So the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, it talked about, and how about both sides are now accusing each other of violating that. The Conventional Arms Forces in Europe Treaty, Russia pulled out of that this year, and they're saying they're no longer going to participate in that. And so this is having major consequences within Europe. As part of the that Conventional Armed Forces in Europe Treaty, both Europe and Russia, they did not hold big military drills or big military buildups without notifying the other side and giving each side plenty of notice, you know, to just avoid scaring off each other and avoid having big military drills that could be construed as a preparation for war. Russia has pulled out of that. Now they're having these big military drills at short notice, these big military buildups. And then this is having a response when it comes to nuclear forces in Europe. So this article talks about how you've got the nuclear sharing agreement within NATO. And this agreement is where America has basically loaned out nuclear bombs to different European countries, most notably Germany, I think, is in there, Italy, Turkey. And these are tactical nukes. I believe they're variable yield bombs, which means, at least the more modern ones are, which means that the nation with the bomb can make it a fairly small nuclear bomb. I don't want to say small nuclear explosion because it's a nuclear explosion. It's going to be pretty big still. But for a nuclear explosion, a small one or a big one. So they're kind of multi-purpose. So this convention or this nuclear sharings looks like it was going to fade out. A lot of nations were getting fed up of the expense of holding these nuclear bombs. The people don't tend to like to live near nuclear bases, so there was some discontent within the local population. And then everything erupts with Russia, with Ukraine. Russia starts pulling out of these different treaties. And now suddenly, because of that, this nuclear sharing agreement isn't going anywhere. And this article doesn't talk about it, but we talked about it last week on the program. There are more and more noises from Poland saying that they want into this nuclear sharing agreement. And so actually, with this breakdown in all of these treaties, it could lead to more nuclear weapons within Europe, and it could lead to America stationing more nuclear weapons in Europe. And then we have another article in the Trumpet Weekly that ties in very strongly to this trend called German arms builders buck downward trend. And so what we're seeing now is that German arms builders are benefiting from this situation. It looks like they're going to benefit even more in the future because Eastern Europe is now buying up more German arms. This article talked about how ThyssenKrupp is doing well from it because it's, I mean, Germany is one of the world leading nations when it comes to making high quality diesel submarines. And they're in high demand right now, which is very interesting, but a separate subject. But it also talks about how a lot of Eastern European nations are now coming to Germany and buying German hardware. So Lithuania said last week that they're going to buy 88 German-made Boxer armored fighting vehicles. There's some of these other groups like Krauss Maffei Wegmann, Rheinmetall. They're getting ready to sell more German Leopard 2 tanks than they think that Eastern European nations are now going to be wanting to buy more German tanks, upgrade these weapons. And so you're seeing just this, like this article talks about, this build up now from Europe in response to this breakdown in these post-Cold War treaties. And so you could quite easily now go back to the situation that we had in the Cold War, where you once again have this unrestrained arms race between Europe and between Russia, as each races against the other to build up their forces. And the result of this will be more nukes in Europe. It will mean those nukes won't leave Europe, and it will mean Eastern European nations are buying more tanks and more armor, most notably from Germany.
It's a really fascinating story because you have, as is the case in so many of these international arenas, or anytime you have agreements between nations, you have these best laid plans of men that tend to go awry as soon as geopolitical reality trumps it. You know, it's all fine and good to say, well, we're going to dispense with all of these weapons, but as soon as you have a power that says, well, we're actually going to start taking the lead, we're going to be more aggressive, then all of that goes out the window. And Europe is really in a place where it's hearing these tidings out of the East, and it's saying, well, we've got to do something to protect ourselves against this. That's just kind of the reality of the world that we're in, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it gets back to something we kind of finished talking about on the Trumpet Daily this morning. We were quoting from George Friedman in his book, where he talks about how nothing has really changed within Europe, that mankind, they're still human, and humans still behave in the same way. And so, you know, we've seen throughout history these type of agreements may have had some temporary effect, but man has never been able to come up with some kind of treaty system that stops war and that stops arms buildup. It's been the case throughout all of history, and so it's going to remain the case now.
Well, thank you, Richard. These stories are in this week's edition of the Trumpet Weekly. I want to encourage you to subscribe to this free weekly news report. Just go online to thetrumpet.com and become a Trumpet Weekly subscriber. Coming up, we're going to look at important news from Asia and Anglo-America, and later on, we'll have our lightning round of headlines from all our panelists. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
You're listening to our Week in Review program. We're going to turn now to Asia, and Jeremiah Jacques will start with the overview of Asian headlines.
Okay, well, yesterday, Russian President Vladimir Putin chimed in on the U.S. presidential race, saying that Donald Trump is the absolute frontrunner. Putin also described Trump as a very colorful and very talented person. So it's hard to say whether Putin's unofficial endorsement there will work for or against Trump, but it is interesting that Mr. Putin is watching what's going on in the leadership of Russia's number one adversary. And then also this week, we saw Taiwan receive an arms package proposal from the Obama administration, and this package was described as modest and insufficient. Many Taiwanese are really worried that it will not be enough to allow Taiwan to defend itself against China in the event of a Chinese attack or invasion.
All right, and your top story from Asia this week?
Well, the top story is that Russia and China are terrifying U.S. military officials with their development of what is called enhanced human operations. Enhanced human operations entail modifying soldiers' bodies and brains in order to create basically super soldiers. So this really sounds like something out of a science fiction film, but it's a story published in Popular Mechanics this week, and it's called Russia and China's Enhanced Human Operations Terrify the Pentagon. And the article quotes U.S. Defense Secretary Deputy Bob Work saying that Russia and China are investing just all kinds of effort into these Enhanced Human Operations, or EHOs. And Mr. Work is concerned that America will soon lose some key aspects of its military competitive advantage if it does not pursue some of these same kinds of developments.
So what kind of developments are we talking about specifically?
Well, the Pentagon has not been very specific about the details of what kinds of enhancements are being made to soldiers in Russia and China. But the Popular Mechanics piece does a little bit of speculation based on projects that DARPA has embarked upon in recent years. DARPA is the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. It's responsible for the highest level of military research and development. And so one of the projects involves an exoskeleton. This is DARPA actually teamed up with the U.S. Special Operations Command back in 2013 to produce a prototype for these exoskeletons. And it's a long way off from the Iron Man suit that some listeners may be familiar with, but its final version would apparently protect soldiers from chemical, biological, electromagnetic, and ballistic threats. And some plans even include audio, visual, and haptic or touch sensors as being part of the design. Then there's also the aspect of drugs and vaccines. Already there are a lot of reports showing that groups like the Islamic State pump their soldiers full of hallucinogens and other kinds of drugs just to bolster their savagery. And then there are reports about mind-altering pain vaccines being developed as well. One of these, if a soldier is shot, he could be injected with a vaccine that would theoretically eliminate the pain from the shot, as well as the inflammation and swelling. He would have a minute or two of agony, but then he would be able to soldier on for hours and hours, even days at a time, without feeling any pain. And then there's also anti-sleep drugs, such as modafinil, which would allow troops to fight for a long time, days upon end, without needing any sleep. And from there, it just gets even more bizarre. It goes into things like brain implants. If you look back at the history of the Soviet Union, there are reports about scientists inserting gold electrodes into soldiers' brains with the goal of eliminating the pain center. And now Mr. Work says that there are indications that such experiments are still underway. So it's some interesting stuff. A lot of this development by Russia and China is still unconfirmed, and it's all sort of on the fringes of the more significant concrete aspects of the rise of these Asian military powerhouses. But it still serves to show just the kind of dangerous mindset that we're dealing with in the leadership of Russia and China.
Right. These are the types of techniques that we would really look down on. I mean, to say we don't want a soldier to feel pain so that he just continues to go on and battle, even though there may be something really wrong with his body, that's not really putting his well-being as a priority.
Yeah, exactly. And for that reason, it is a really delicate topic. That's what Mr. Work says. For military personnel in the U.S., this is very delicate because you're talking about altering human beings from the inside to be able to fight more effectively in combat. So it really presents some serious ethical dilemmas. But it shows that an authoritarian regime such as that in Russia and China, they just have an utter disregard for human rights.
Right, which they prove in a lot of different ways. I mean, I guess that's why, say, a story like this has a certain amount of resonance, or it's not that hard to believe just because of what you see them doing in so many other areas.
Yes. Yeah, and it's very worrying. It just shows this no-holds-barred kind of mentality, and it could make a military just stunningly ruthless and successful to have that sort of a mindset toward its soldiers. And I'm sure that European nations are taking note of these kinds of developments, and they're concerned by them. So in a way, this really just shows another aspect of how those tidings out of the East, what, you know, what's happening there in Russia and China with their rise, are frightening. And it's easy to see how they will frighten European nations and galvanize them just to be ready for conflict.
You know, something that we talk about quite often is just how the Bible's description of World War III and the next the next global scale warfare is going to be so much worse than World War II. And in one sense, it's easy to see how that could be the case when you look at, say, the distribution of nuclear weapons and how much that would factor in even in the earlier stages of a war. But it's hard in some ways to imagine warfare that would be more savage than what was witnessed in World War II. And yet, I just listening to this, it makes me wonder if this might give some kind of indication of how there could be elements of that war that really would be worse. If you've got soldiers that are out there and they're basically operating in a pain-free environment, and they're hyped up, souped up on hallucinogenic drugs that are increasing their rage, and they're not acting like normal human beings, or maybe they do have certain technological enhancements that make them deadlier and being able to increase the power and the force that they have on the battlefield. Maybe it gives some indication of what sort of nightmares might be in our future. But you certainly would have to, like you suggested, say that armies within the United States, we're the ones, I guess it was the Pentagon that revealed this, but if this information is out there, how there would be European military planners who would be really concerned about this and feel like they had to do something, or, you know, that this would increase their, just like so many other areas, say, we've got to do something about this rising threat from Asia.
Yes. Yeah, that's exactly right. This is a, it really paints a bleak picture of what the next war might look like. It's been said that no weapon has ever been developed that has not eventually been used on, you know, against an enemy force by a certain army. So when we hear reports like this, you just have to think that it's really resonating with some of the military leaders and potential military leaders there in Europe, and the end result will not be pretty.
You're listening to our Week in Review program. We're going to move now to Anglo-America and Robert Morley. Let's start with an overview, Robert.
Sure. So this week, the trial over the death of Freddie Gray resulted in a mistrial. It was a hung jury. And this angered a lot of people. I think it reinforced the beliefs of many people in the United States that black people just cannot get justice in this nation. Perhaps the biggest travesty of the whole situation is that this trial has progressed, it's become increasingly evident that it probably shouldn't have proceeded even in the first place. The case against the officer, who, by the way, is also black, was very, very weak. And several legal experts are saying that it shouldn't have gone to trial. The trial judges themselves should have dismissed it. And this was probably a case of the prosecuting attorney making a political statement and bringing this officer to trial because it was such a high-profile case and death. Also this week, oil prices have been cascading. It's been a catastrophic 18 months for crude oil. It's down 68% due to a massive supply gut. This week, oil hit a fresh seven-year low below $34.50 a barrel. This is great when we go fill up at the gas station. Good aspects economically, but there's also some problems that are starting to develop. For example, in credit markets, a lot of these companies, these fracking companies, are starting to go bankrupt, and we're finding out that most of their activities were all financed by debt. So we're starting to see impacts hitting the junk bond market, and we'll probably talk a little bit more about that later.
All right, and your top story for this week, she finally did it.
She did it. Janet Yellen, she raised interest rates. This is the first time the Federal Reserve has raised interest rates in 9 years. She did that on Wednesday. But for those of us who might be yearning for the days when we actually earned a little interest in our savings account, sorry, there's bad news for all of you. As expected, the Federal Open Market Committee, they increased their interest rate range.
5%? 7%?
Well, how about 0.25%? Okay. So the Federal Reserve now, its range, which used to be from 0 to 0.25, is now from 0.25 to 0.5%. But still, some people are calling this an end of an era. For the last 7 years, interest rates in America have been essentially zero. And you've noticed that, as you said, in your savings account. But markets, they seem to take it pretty well. The Dow Jones jumped, actually up on the news, 200 points. But there is a lot of discussion out there about, was this the time to raise rates? And should have the Fed done more? Should have the Fed held off? And I think the best way to think about this is that it probably didn't matter what Janet Yellen did. For the last 7 years, we've lived in a world of zero interest rates. And that's caused incredible distortions within America's economy. There are speculative bubbles that are growing out there, some that we're aware of, some that we are not aware of, that are growing. Sitka Pacific analyst Mike Shedlock was talking about this in the lead up, and he said, the bubbles are there. It's just a matter of time before they pop. Janet Yellen, she starts raising rates quickly, those bubbles will pop sooner. If she holds off, they're just going to be bigger and more devastating later. But let me just give you an idea of some of these stress points that we're seeing in the economy. And the Fed's very aware of these, but there's not a lot that they can do about it. And they tossed their dice 7 years ago, and when they left interest rates low for so long, debt has been building up in America at unprecedented levels. We are at nowhere, never before have we lived in an age with so much debt as we have now in America, and not just America, around the world.
And just to precede this, the debt's there, so as soon as the interest rates start to rise, the debt becomes more expensive, and so it's an even bigger problem than it was to start with.
Sure. Let's just take a look at the U.S. federal debt, working towards $19 trillion. Currently at record low interest rates. Interest rates low, they've never been so low ever in the history of the world. We're paying $200 billion in net interest a year. That's a lot of money. And that's at the lowest rates have ever been. We start getting rates normalized to where they were a decade ago before we started cutting, when they're up around 5%, 6%,
right.
We're going to see interest payments on the national debt easily triple. The interest on the national debt could become very quickly a bigger component of U.S. budget than we spend on the defense industry. And that's not a wild guess. There's people warning about that. So these things are coming if rates ever do normalize, if they ever get back that
high. I think I'd do pretty well on a 0.25% return on $19 trillion. I could live on that, I think.
Well, absolutely. Even with such record low interest rates, we are financing China's military bill. If you look how much they're spending on their military, the amount we're paying in interest is funding that. But let me just give you one example of these bubbles before we move on here. This week, Anheuser-Busch InBev, the big beer company that owns Budweiser, they announced that they had secured funding for a loan to buy their rival Saab Miller. And they announced that they had secured funding for a loan for $75 billion.
That's a big loan.
Yeah, big loan. This is the biggest loan in the history of the world. There's, as far as we know, there's never been a loan so big issued. And to make this even crazier, the interest rate they're paying on this loan, 1.1%. Above the LIBOR rate, the Fed's rate. It just shows you the distortions in the market, that there would be people out there willing to put together $75 billion to lend to a company at such low interest rates. Well, that's a result of the Fed. This is just one example. Deals like this have been happening for the past 7 years because interest rates have been so low. But interest rates are going to rise. Good luck to, you know, InBev several years down the road when they have to refinance this loan. They're never going to pay this loan off. They're going to, like every other business in America, they're going to borrow new money to pay back the old loans. They're going to try to roll it over. Well, good luck when they try to do that. And we're seeing that even now. The junk bond market has been collapsing these last 2 weeks. It really took a turn for the worse this week. These are a lot of those companies that had easy money because everybody wanted to lend their money out at higher rates than what the Fed was offering. So they took risk. They went out there and lend it to companies with junk bond ratings. You know, they have junk ratings for a reason, but people were so desperate for any kind of yield that we have this massive bubble in the junk bond market. So bad now that we had a mutual fund this week suspend redemptions. Mutual fund's supposed to be very safe. And this was a bond fund, which is supposed to be even safer. And this isn't in a time where we're in an economic crisis, supposedly. And here they are saying, you can't get your money out of this. And this is a multi-billion dollar bond fund. So there are a lot of these stress fractures out there in the economy. And we're seeing areas that we thought were safe just years ago showing characteristics of bubbles that should be very, very worrying.
Hmm. Well, thank you for that, Robert. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive a free subscription to The Trumpet Weekly, this weekly news report. The stories we're talking about are in this week's edition. We'll finish the program with our lightning round of important news from all our panelists. That's coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
It's time now for our lightning round, but before we get into that, I just want to give Robert 30 seconds to tell us what you just told us at the break.
Sure. We were just talking about another sign of the bubble, that the bubbles that are building in the United States. San Francisco is offering a new loan program to help people get into houses, help poor people get into houses. It's called the POPI Loan Program. This stands for the Proud Ownership Purchase Program. But check this out. This program allows customers to borrow up to $2 million with no money down at 4% interest. So here we are. We're helping poor people. $2 million?
I mean, that's a nice home.
Yeah. And get this. And get this. And it also allows the borrowers to take out this loan without having to take private mortgage insurance out either. Thank you very much, taxpayers. We'll pick that tab up. And welcome to your $2 million house. We're back in the bubble days. I mean, this is what caused the last crisis, this very thing right here.
All right, that was more than 30 seconds. We're going to look at one last look at some of the headlines from this week that caught our attention, starting with Anthony.
Okay, over the weekend, the Nigerian army massacred about 1,000 Shiite Muslims in the north of the country. Now, these Shiite Muslims were being accused of plotting to overthrow the Nigerian military. So the military killed a lot of them. They conducted these raids and killed a lot of them. And Iran was so furious about that. On Tuesday, Iran called on the Nigerian president to investigate those deaths, and it even summoned the foreign minister to explain that. Now, why is Iran so mad about this? Well, one of the reasons is that Iran is Shiite, and these people were Shiites. But the more important reason why Iran was infuriated by this is because this group of people who were killed, it's called the Islamic Movement of Nigeria. It's a group that's sponsored by Iran, and it's planning to create an Islamic State in Nigeria via a revolution similar to the Iranian Revolution. So we can see more evidence of Iran getting into the region, North Africa, and causing chaos and radicalizing the region.
Mm. All right, we'll turn now to Richard.
Fear, anger, and hatred. The rise of Germany's new right. That's the title of an article from Spiegel in this week's Trumpet Weekly. It was really an excellent article. It was very hard to trim it down, to cut it down for this week's Trumpet Weekly. But it talks about how what used to be kind of far-right, anti-immigrant positions are now moving to the mainstream, and how that this trend is just becoming more dramatic with each passing month. So it says in there, for example, in the past, the right wing was characterized primarily by thugs with shaved heads, bomber jackets, and jackboots. A bit further down, it said these extremists are still around, but they have received reinforcements. And then it goes on to talk about how joining this kind of what was in used to be extremists are now people from the center of society. Intellectuals, devout Christians, even people it talks about on the left as well, Putin admirers, anti-globalization activists, radical pacifists. It writes, movements are growing together that have never before been part of the same camp. So you've got this powerful new movement growing. And then it also talks about how there are new people even joining the extremists, people who have never been extreme before. So it talks about how the German Federal Criminal Police Office has found that not even a third of people that have been committing attacks on immigrants and immigration shelters, not even a third have had previous encounters with the authorities. The majority had spotless records before they marched off to their local refugee hostel. So most of the people who are setting fire to refugees who are committing these attacks, and the article goes through a whole load of very worrying statistics about how fast these attacks are increasing. The people that are doing that are not kind of skinhead thugs who are always in and out of problems with the police. They're people who have never been in trouble with the police before, ever. And so there's a big spread in the number of people within Germany who are being radicalized.
And now we'll go to Jeremiah.
Well, China and Pakistan this week pledged to further firm up their all-weather ties and high-level contact. This is in all areas, politics, economics, and military. China and Pakistan were already close allies, and now it's set to draw them even closer together. Pakistan, of course, is a Muslim-majority country, but this new pledge is just one of many indications showing that Pakistan might throw its weight behind Russia and China.
All right, thank you. And we'll go now to Robert.
Well, a proposal to admit 10,000 Syrian refugees in the United States has, as you're probably aware, ignited a pretty bitter debate. This was something that a lot of the Republican presidential contenders were talking about this week. But as it turns out, according to Fox News, 10 times that number of people from Syria have already been admitted to the United States since 2012. Over 100,000 Syrians are in the United States, living here, working here, and studying here. And some analysts who are looking at this, some people are very concerned that that's where the real danger is in terms of terrorism in the United States, not from those necessarily coming, but from those that are already here. Something to be aware of.
Well, I just wanted to mention the fact that America is sending its women into combat. Defense Secretary Ash Carter announced on December 3rd that the U.S. military is going to open up all positions to women, no exceptions. He said they'll be allowed to drive tanks, fire mortars, and lead infantry soldiers into combat. They'll be able to serve as Army Rangers and Green Berets, Navy SEALs, Marine Corps infantry, Air Force parajumpers, and everything else that was previously open only to men. President Obama is excited. He says this is going to make our military even stronger because, quote, our armed forces will draw on an even wider pool of talent. That's amazing logic. Like, there's been this huge number of women who would be absolutely capable of making it through special forces training, but the only thing holding them back is this sexist policy that restricts those jobs to men. Actually, Navy SEAL training, BUDS training, it has a 75% to 80% attrition rate. So only about 2 out of 10 of the best men in the Navy make it through this training. And these are a lot of super tough dudes dropping out because that training is so tough. But now I guess it's going to be an even better force because women are going to be making it through there somehow. Kathleen Parker in the Washington Post said this, because of physical differences, including the fact that men have 40% more upper body muscle mass, women are at a disadvantage in combat, which often requires long deployments of deprivation and hardship, including toting 60 to 100 pounds of equipment. It also means fighting close up, aggressively pursuing the enemy with the expectation of possible physical contact. Plainly put, women do not have an equal opportunity to survive. And she quotes a Marine combat veteran who commanded an infantry platoon and a rifle company in Vietnam. He said, it's hard for me to imagine how women under heavy fire and carrying 60 pounds of equipment would have survived. These feminists who are sitting in the comfort of their offices are putting their agenda above the safety of these women and above even the effectiveness of these forces. One final quote from this Washington Post article, another veteran of the same war summed it up. If indelicately, there is a difference between a bunch of wimpy officers, not the term he used, trying to get promoted for being politically correct, and a combat battle-ready Marine unit in the field. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Look us up online at thetrumpet.com. We'll be happy to give you a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. The stories we've talked about on the program today are in this week's edition. We'd love to hear from you. Email us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Richard Palmer, Anthony Chabotterway, Jeremiah Jacques, and Robert Morley.
Pleasure. Welcome to be having here. Us.
Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Bret Stephens. Foreign policy is not the business of making dreams come true. It's about keeping our nightmares at bay. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on The Voice, 101.3 KPCG, and on the web at kpcg.fm.